You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.
Hi, and welcome to SpyCast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, the museum brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. Join us as we take a closer look at the secret world of intelligence.
We'd like to welcome two new sponsors to the SpyCast family, M8Z Choice and Scotty Vest. You'll hear more about these innovative companies a little later, but first, let's meet our guests.
So we're joined today from the UK by Henry Hemming, who is the author of five works of nonfiction, including In Search of the English Eccentric, Misadventures in the Middle East, the New York Times bestseller The Ingenious Mr. Pike, which is about an extraordinarily interesting man, Jeffrey Pike, who is at the center of many of the key intelligence special operations decisions in World War II. If you don't know anything about him, I suggest grabbing that book. His latest book is Agent M, The Lives and Spies of MI5's Maxwell Knight. Henry's written for the Sunday Times, Daily Telegraph, Daily Mail, The Times, The Economist, FT Magazine, and The Washington Post, and has given interviews on Radio 4's Today's program and NBC's The Today Show. And now an interview on SpyCast. So welcome, Henry. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So whenever we talk to authors who deal with anything that's specific about espionage, even from the World War II time period where everything hasn't been declassified, I really want to ask a question about sources, because for any intelligence historian, anyone writing about this stuff, source material can be the biggest frustration. So how much of what you've done was recently declassified? Basically, why is now the only time you could have written this book?
Because of a change that took place within MI5 about 15, 20 years ago. And because of that change, I think now is a golden age of intelligence history writing, certainly in Britain. And so this came about quite soon after the collapse of the Soviet Union, where within MI5 it was decided that that they would start releasing documents which had been previously classified and just make them available to the public in the National Archives. And this has been extraordinary. So it means that every few months, usually every kind of 5-6 months, there will be a big dump of previously classified stuff. And of course, some bits will be redacted, but a lot of it is not. And as a result, there is an absolute wealth of material. A lot of it has still not been gone through. And in answer to your question, most of my book was based on new material, which sheds light on Maxwell Knight. And it was fantastic. I mean, that feeling as a historian that you're going through stuff that no other historian has seen is completely thrilling. So it was an exciting thing to research. And it's been lovely to put this story together for the first time into the book, Agent M.
Yeah, there's nothing better than a feeling for a historian of seeing a document that the last time it was seen was probably by the person who wrote it or received it.
Exactly. It's lovely, and every now and again there will be a slip, i.e. there'll be something which the MI5 archivist did not redact, which will shed light on something which maybe you're not meant to see. So for example, one of Max Knight's agents, so a guy who was working as an MI5 agent for probably about 10 years in total, he's someone who's never been identified. His code name was M1. And I found huge amounts about him. So I got a pretty good sense of who this guy was, roughly where he lived, roughly who his friends were. I became reasonably obsessed with working out his identity. And I got it down to about three possible candidates. And there was this lovely moment where in one of these really obscure files, there's a reference to somebody called HG. And And initially, I thought, this doesn't work. The initials of my three candidates, none of them is first name H, second name G. But then I realized this guy actually had a middle name. This guy was H.G. Pollard. He was known to all of his friends as H.G. And this is a crucial clue. And it was only because I'd seen so many other documents that this one tiny detail, which probably didn't make sense to an MI5 archivist, made sense to me, and therefore I was able to identify this particular guy. He was an extraordinary bookseller, a bon vivant, a bohemian, somebody who was famous towards the end of his life as being one of the great bibliographers in British history. A guy called Graham Pollard, son of a famous academic. And it turns out that for about 10 years, early on in his life, he infiltrated the Communist Party on behalf of Maxwell Knight. So he ended up working for MI6 and for MI5. And he even married a communist at one point to, I think, mainly to improve his cover. But then he fell out of love with her, and I think he also fell out of love with the job he was doing. And so he moved on to a different life. But yeah, that was just one of the things I was able to find out as a result of being one of the first historians to go through all of this stuff.
I have a lot of overall praise for this book, but I think one of the things that really stands out to me is almost the detective story of you trying to piece together the identities of these agents based on just lots and lots of different information. I mean, was your house at home like one of those murder boards where there's all lines linking one person to another? Because a lot of it's fascinating, kind of how you hunker down and found all these documents with just bits and pieces of information that eventually would lead you to identify just about everybody.
Exactly. And yes, there was a time when my house was beginning to look like that. And we all know that feeling when you find yourself on a detective trail and you just become obsessed with finding the answer. And the lovely thing about, I mean, it's not like quantum physics, as in with these, you really know there is an answer. You know that there is an identity and you just got to work it out. So it's quite a satisfying kind of detection. But what you also have is, not only is MI5 releasing just vast quantities of material every year, but at the same time, you have all sorts of other databases that are being digitized and put online. So you have records of, for example, ship manifests or electoral registers are increasingly going online. And basically this means that if you're trying to identify someone, it's 100 times easier than it was 20 years ago. So combination of MI5 being a bit more open about its past and the internet and digitization has made it a fun time to be doing this detective work.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the hero of your book, Maxwell Knight, because he's not just a normal guy. Let's call him eccentric. I think that's probably the nicest thing. Yeah, we can say about him, because he's really kind of the black sheep of his family. This is he was somebody who was not necessarily the same as everybody growing up in Britain at the time. He liked jazz. He liked things, more bohemian things than others. And his fascination, again, we'll use a euphemism there, with animals really stands out as part of his background.
Absolutely. He's, I think without being, being a kind of poor man's Freud, I think a lot of it goes back to his dad, to his parents. He was the youngest, and he had a distant father who was too busy having affairs with women who would he'd live with them off in the south of France. So Maxwell Knight was desperate to get the attention of his father. And I think one of the ways he did that was by collecting and looking after unusual animals. And he knew that this is one of the few things that really piqued his father's interest. So as a young boy, you're right, he got into looking after unusual animals. But he soon realized that he had a knack for it. He was really good, that animals would trust him in the way that they would not naturally trust other people. And I'm sort of a little bit wary of implying that he had some kind of magical gift. But I think he just had a lot of practice. He had a hell of a lot of practice. And at the same time, he was someone who was a good listener. He was a good watcher. He was naturally sensitive. So very early on, he develops this extraordinary ability to look after and tame just wild animals that he finds in the woods and fields around his home. And what I argue in the book is that this is one of the things that helps him become an extraordinary MI5 agent runner. So there are lots of parallels between the way he ran agents and the way he would look after these stray animals that he found. And he'd even look for agents who were quite similar to the animals he found in terms of being injured, in terms of having lost their parents, in terms of being the odd ones out in various ways. So that was his way into it all, I guess. He also, I think, was someone who liked to be known. He liked to be a colorful character. And this is why he ended up being the black sheep of his family. Maxwell Knight was kicked out of his family. He was cut off financially. And it's at this absolute low in his life, quite early on, that the man who become M gets taken on by a private intelligence agency. And for the first time, at last, he's found a job that he can do well. And up until then, he just simply hasn't.
Yeah, let's talk about the McGill organization, which you just referenced. I think it's important that we lay this out for our listeners about why, and this is talking about like 1919, right after World War One ends. Why was this a time, number one, that you needed a private intelligence organization? Why not just have MI5 and MI6? But also, what kind of perception in Europe, and especially in the UK, is there about how the world is changing?
Yeah, well, I mean, the simple answer is the Soviet Union, that this is all roads lead back to the Soviet Union, that there was an enormous fear within not just one part of British society, but in many parts of British society, that the country would end up becoming a socialist republic, and that Moscow and international communism was agitating for this to happen. And the place where that kind of fear really matters for us in terms of what we're talking about is amongst a political and industrial elite. People who ran enormous companies were worried about strikes and were just worried about there being a revolution as there had been in Russia and them getting killed in the process of that. So it was self-preservation as much as love of their country that was driving this fear. So this fear existed. It's something that I think historically in the kind of scheme of the 1920s, it's something that perhaps isn't focused on enough. But it's something which drove a lot of people in Britain who had the authority and the power to do so to try and take active measures themselves. And one of the people who did that was Sir George McGill, who sort of fits the stereotype perfectly. He was a well-off, right-wing industrialist. And he decided that Moscow was in danger of taking over his country. And so he set up a private intelligence agency and began to feed different agents into every trade union he could find, into communist groups, everywhere he thought there might be the risk of penetration by Soviet agents. And he would then report, he would pass on the information that he gathered. He passed it on to MI5 and to MI6, who at the time did not have enough money, and also politically, the people who were directing them didn't quite see the threat to the Soviet Union in the same way that people like McGill did.
I think that, you know, for our listeners, it's important for us to lay out how you talk about them not having a lot of money at MI5 and MI6, but I think let's be a little more specific about that. By the mid-20s, they barely existed at all.
Yeah, and there was even talk in the mid-20s of abolishing it altogether. It had no full-time agents in the mid-20s. It had a threadbare staff, less than 20 officers, and a handful of clerks and secretaries. And it was a backwater within Whitehall. It had very little clout. That was partly the fault of the guy who ran it, who was a perfectly nice, well-meaning guy who had done well during the war, but was not a good political operator. So he was someone who did not always get meetings with senior British politicians when he asked for them. So MI5 had become a backwater. It didn't have enough money. And because of just the titanic debt that Britain had incurred during the First World War, there were cuts across government. And MI5 was victim to that as much as anyone else, or possibly more so. So they were an absolute fraction of what they were today, what they are today. I mean, MI5 right now has something like 4,000 officers, just to put that in perspective.
So Knight was somebody who had no training. We're not talking about somebody that's gone through any kind of formalized training when he's put into this McGill organization. And through really trial and error, he becomes an extraordinary agent. I talk about someone who's a natural for this kind of work.
Absolutely. He had no training. And this was part of what McGill actually wanted from his agents. He wanted them to be natural. He was wary, as Maxwell Knight would later be, he was wary of giving people too much training because he was worried they might then just stick out like a sore thumb. So he had almost no training. And I think, funny enough, I mean, his training, such as it was, came from reading John Buchan novels, from reading The 39 Steps and Greenmantle and books like that. And, I mean, a broader point to make is that a lot of people in British intelligence in the 20s and certainly the early 30s fell into the same category, that their main experience, because there's a lack of training, their main experience of how to be a spy initially would come from the novels they had read. So there's this strange and interesting and rich interchange between the myth of espionage and the reality of it. But in terms of Maxwell Knight inside the McGill organization, he'd found his groove, I think, mainly because he was careful to be patient. He was watchful. He made sure not to stand out, and he found that he wasn't natural. And very soon he found himself running the intelligence department within the organization that he'd been told to infiltrate, which is kind of ridiculous. So suddenly he finds himself in this incredibly powerful position. And at that moment, he makes the crossover from being a straightforward agent to being an agent and an agent runner. So he starts taking on his own agents. And in terms of the book, this is when I think it gets much more exciting.
This is when he begins to develop
new craft.
Right. We're not talking about a couple people here and a couple people there. We're talking about dozens and dozens of agents that he's running at the same time.
Absolutely. And there's this amazing line from a report where he describes that in his first year as an agent runner, he's successfully taken on more than 50 sources. And I sense actually because of the person he was writing to, it would have been hard for him to exaggerate that. And so we've got to assume that there were quite a few people who did not take up his call to report back to him. So in other words, in the space of a year, he has approached, I imagine, something like 80, 90 individuals and asked them to work for him as a spy. And that's a lot. I mean, you would learn the job incredibly quickly. Just by practicing that much. So he puts himself through this incredibly rigorous trial and error introduction to espionage. And by the end of it, he's become incredibly good.
We'll have more with Henry in a moment, but let me take a moment to tell you a little about MHZ Choice. MHZ Choice is a streaming service that features European mysteries, dramas, and comedies, streamed right to your computer, TV, or favorite device. What's cool about this is that these are not shows you've likely seen ever before, and they have some amazing spy-related content. Things like the Weissensee Saga. Now, I pronounced that right, I think. I practice it over and over. But the Weissensee Saga is a cool drama about a Stasi family in 1980s East Berlin. What's really interesting is it's filmed on location at the site of the actual Stasi headquarters, which is now a museum in East Berlin. There's also Cenk Batu, undercover agent. A story about a guy born in Germany to Turkish parents. He's an undercover agent with the State Bureau of Investigation in Hamburg. His ability to analyze people and situations put to good use as he works on a wide variety of cases ranging from industrial espionage and financial crimes to terror cells and political assassinations. Then you got the Hamilton Collection. No, this is not the exploits of the musically singing founding father. These are four different series that are based on and inspired by the novels of Swedish author and journalist John Julu, centering around the exploits of fictional Swedish super spy Carl Hamilton. I'm talking about hours of television focused on spy TV shows and spy movies that you've never seen anywhere else. And they're really, really cool. I mean, I won't single one of them out, but I think you can get the idea of which one I find the coolest. They also have TV adaptations from some of the world's best crime fiction writers, including Agatha Christie, Donna Leon, and Camilla Läckberg. New content is added every single week, so you'll always have something new to watch, all with English subtitles. You'll get that plus the entire MHZ Choice library, which includes over 2,500 hours of binge-worthy TV for only $7.99 a month. But you don't even have to pay that at first. You can try MHZ Choice free for 30 days. And even after that, if you decide to stick around, you'll save 50% off your first month.
So visit m8zchoice.com/spycast and use the code SPYCAST at checkout. That's mhzchoice.com/spycast and use the promo code SPYCAST at checkout.
So he's still working for a private organization at this point. At what point does Maxwell Knight start working for the British government?
So he is working informally at this point for someone who works at MI6. And it all becomes a little bit convoluted and complicated. But he's working informally for a guy called Desmond Morton, who would later become Churchill's senior security advisor. And Desmond Morton is at MI6, but this is a secret. So no one else at that time is allowed to know about this. And then after about 3-4 years of working for McGill, Max Knight gets taken on by MI6. And this is going fine, but then it all falls apart. And amazingly, it's because of something that Maxwell Knight himself did. And so I won't get into the specifics of the turf war that followed, but I suppose the kind of the salient point in terms of Agent M, in terms of his character's development, is that he was told not to mention his work to a particular person, and he couldn't resist doing this. So he ends up telling the head of the special branch. He hints that he's back in the game, that he is working for MI6. And there follows a titanic power struggle within Whitehall, and then Maxwell Knight is kicked out of MI6 as a result of this. And I was intrigued by this when I was doing the research. I mean, for a book like this to really work, you have to have a character that can sustain 300 pages of dramatic tension. And it was this moment when I realized that Maxwell Knight was someone who could, and that he has this fundamental flaw. That there he is working in espionage, and yet at the same time he is deep down. He's a bit of a show off. He likes to be seen. He likes occasionally being the center of attention. And there are regular moments during his career where this becomes his great, not his downfall so much, but it becomes something that holds him up. And I was really intrigued by this. So he gets kicked out of MI6 as a result of something he had done. But amazingly, he doesn't leave British intelligence. Instead, he gets transferred to MI5. He gets given his own section, and he gets given this extraordinary new job, which is to run MI5's first ever agent running section. And so this is a big breakthrough of his life. And that's where, the plot thickens, shall we say.
And this section is M section, hence the moniker.
Yeah.
Now, what is the focus of the M organization, the M section? It's we're talking about early 1930s. We're not yet thinking about the Nazis yet. What is M originally focusing on?
It's again the Soviet Union. So his job was pretty simple. He had to get agents inside the Communist Party, inside the Communist underground, and try and find the connections between the Communist Party and Moscow. And up until then, MI5, as I was saying earlier, just did not have this intelligence. They didn't have the human resources inside the party. And Maxwell Knight, by that stage, does. So he's got already 4 or 5 agents inside the Communist Party. But they're not quite where he wants them. So he has to come up with a new idea, a new approach to this this particular problem. And he has this innovative approach to what he's the challenge he's been given, which is to take on female secretaries, take them on and turn them into MI5 agents in the hope that they will then get taken on by a senior communist. Because his theory at this point is that if you want to get inside the head of a senior communist, don't just try and get someone to slowly work their way up the organization and become this senior communist equal, but instead just get a secretary and get that secretary working for the senior communist. That way you'll get inside his mind. You'll find out what's really going on in his life. And the funny thing is that by this stage, by the early 1930s, most MI5 officers think it is a massive mistake to use female agents. They think that women would be too indiscreet, that they have a tendency to fall in love with their targets, and they simply lack the staying power of their male equivalents. And so it's interesting, and I think impressive, that Maxwell Knight, on pretty much his first day in the job, says, actually, we're gonna try female agents. And he doesn't just take on one; he takes on at least two. And so there's a lot riding on this when he recruits these two women. And I suppose in some ways the kind of the meat of the book is what happens to these two particular women. They have very different experiences of getting inside the Communist Party.
Let's start with Olga Gray, because she is the M2 Monomond has interesting stories, but Olga Gray is really kind of the heroine of this story.
She is indeed. She's a typist from Birmingham. She is she's someone who had a very difficult relationship with her dad, who gave her a complex about her looks, which is relevant only because at that time, for any young woman who's approached by MI5 and asked, "Do you want to become a spy?" Your assumption is that to be a female spy, you basically have to use your looks. You have to seduce men to steal secrets. You have to use sex. And so for her to say yes was in itself a huge step. And she comes up from Birmingham. She moves to London. And she begins to live this life of pretending to be a secretary and slowly hoping that somebody within the Communist Party will take her on. Eventually they do, and she performs incredibly well. She moves deeper into the Communist Party. She earns the trust of all of the people that she works for. She even at one point gets taken on by Moscow as a Comintern courier. She's sent all the way out to India with various messages and with a large sum of money to deliver to the Indian Communist Party. And she finds crucial details about Communist Party's link to Moscow, which completely changed the British government's understanding of how Moscow is operating and just the extent of their ambitions, really, within Britain. And so she does more than anyone else working for MI5 to adjust and enhance the government's understanding of Soviet espionage within Britain in the 1930s. And indeed, she's been described by Christopher Andrew in his authorized history at MI5 as MI5's leading agent in the years between the war. So she's an amazing find. She was an ordinary member of the public, and Max von Knight turned her into an extraordinary agent. And she ends up being the heroine of this extraordinary spy scandal, where there is a Soviet spy ring operating in a military industrial complex in Britain, and she gets to the very heart of it. So she is the person running their safe house. She's the person who's been asked to take photographs for this group, and she is completely trusted by everyone inside this. And so she then provides the intelligence which brings this down. There is a court case in 1938, and what was amazing was reading the accounts in the New York Times and the Atlanta Constitution and so on of this dramatic court case. And you'd think that their emphasis would be on the four Soviet agents who are in the dock, but the only person they can write about is Olga Gray. They describe her as Britain's counter-espionage heroine, as the most glamorous woman in the country, and so on. And it's an extraordinary journey that she goes on. But there is, to fast forward just for a moment, there is, at the same time, a price that she has to pay for this. And this is one of the themes I really try and look at in Agent M. And it's the cost of being an undercover agent. And Olga Gray, having spent 6 years undercover, telling lies to people she was increasingly fond of, the people she was spying on, telling lies to those people, this began to have a psychological impact. She started to have flashbacks and panic attacks and experience symptoms not dissimilar to post-traumatic stress disorder. And certainly later on in life, these became exaggerated, that they played more of a part in her life. And right at the very end of her life, actually, she had another nervous breakdown as a result of thinking back to the work that she had done for MI5.
Yeah, a big part of her heroism was the fact that she was having some of these psychological issues before she got brought back to help break that big case that you referred to earlier.
Absolutely. And that took enormous courage. I mean, at the same time, this is something which simply has not been written about, so it's pure speculation. But at the same time, I think the role of Maxwell Knight in that is an intriguing one. You know, to what extent did he force her or just persuade her to go back into the field after she had had this nervous breakdown? And that, of course, is something which, you know, that's the kind of question which every spy master today in the 1930s and 100 years from now will be faced with. At what point do you realize that an agent or a source has had enough and needs to be retired? That's one of the intriguing questions that pops up in this book.
We'll hear more about Maxwell Knight in a moment, but let me tell you a little more about Scotty Vest. This is a new sponsor for the show, but the Spy Museum has actually been carrying these in our retail store for some time. That's where I first saw a Scotty Vest. I was like, these are the coolest clothes ever. Scotty Vest designs hoodies, jackets, pants, and vests that are like, well, Inspector Gadget cool, with tons of secret hidden pockets. Scotty Vest revolutionized the clothing industry with a very simple idea. People need better, smarter pockets. While this is not rocket science, it's pocket science. And engineering clothing with as many as 42 pockets comes with a laundry list of considerations and challenges. From strategic pocket size and placement to more advanced features such as the personal area network, weight management system, and TEC with the technology-enabled clothing, Scotty Vest has left no stone unturned in its quest to create the most useful and versatile garments on the market. Wear a Scotty Vest once, and you'll understand all the detail that goes into creating fully functional fashion design for your life. Look, if you're into gadgets like me, you'll dig the inside pockets that hold your cell phone, charger, headphones, extra battery, even an iPad and a laptop. The cool thing is I was able to stop hauling an extra bag or backpack when I travel because all my stuff fits neatly inside my hoodie, jacket, or vest. There's even pockets for my glasses and water bottle, and RFID pockets keep my wallet and credit cards safe. So go check out the jackets, pants, hoodies for men and women. This clothing could change your life. Go to scottyvest.com/spycast, and for a limited time, enter the promo code SPY and get an extra 20% off. That's promo code SPY for 20% off at Scott, the letter E, vest.com/spycast, scottevest.com/spycast, and use our promo code SPY. Well, let me shift quickly to the Germans, because we've been talking about the Soviets at this point, where now we're moving into the mid-1930s. At what point did the target become the Germans? Because you talk in the book about how communism was still the main enemy, even after when Hitler took power, communism was still the main enemy, and you talk about the fact that MI5 at one point even shared intelligence with the Gestapo. So what shifted it, the focus, from the Soviets to the Germans?
Traditionally, the narrative has been that it was the Italian invasion of Abyssinia in the mid-30s. That was the straw that broke the camel's back. But I think the real story is slightly different. The real story is that MI5 accepted that Nazi Germany was the main threat at very different speeds. So different officers assess the threat differently. And Maxwell Knight was, I think he was one of the last to really wake up to the reality of it. And of course, the reason for this is that fascism was originally a reaction to communism. It was, it began with Mussolini, and it was Mussolini's attempt to rid the country of communists. So for everyone who'd gone through that British 1920s political foment, there was this sense that fascism was merely defense of the nation. It was merely trying to make sure the country was safe from the Soviets. And so there was a habit of thought which meant that a lot of people within MI5 and elsewhere in the country were just accustomed to thinking of fascism as something that was basically benign. So it took Maxwell Knight a bit longer than the others. But certainly by 1938, by the Anschluss with Austria, or the Anschluss of Austria, to be more precise, by that point, everybody in MI5 was fully awake to the danger. And there was no doubt in their minds that the greatest threat to world peace at that point was one that came from Berlin.
What did the friendship between Knight and William Joyce, what impact did that have on how slow M came around to viewing the Germans as a threat?
I think maybe that in itself, that relationship in itself, didn't perhaps have an impact. I think it was other things that was having an impact. But that relationship is a perfect microcosm of how M related to fascism And so, just to give the kind of the backstory, William Joyce was a guy that Maxwell Knight had got to know back in the 1920s. They both joined the British fascisti at the same time. Maxwell Knight had done so because he was a spy, and he'd been told to get inside this organization and find out what they're up to. William Joyce joined it for the opposite reason, because he loved their work. He wanted to do everything possible to try and defeat the Soviets. But during the course of them both being inside this organization, they became close friends. And indeed, not just close friends, also sort of rival lovers at one point. As in, William Joyce married the person who was Maxwell Knight's first love. And indeed, this William Joyce's first wife, his mother-in-law, thought that her daughter was going to marry Maxwell Knight instead of William Joyce. So these two people were very close, and they'd gone through a lot together. I mean, I wouldn't call it a straightforward relationship, because there are certainly times when Maxwell Knight would write about this guy and say he's psychotic, he's neurotic, there are a lot of things wrong with him. But he also admired certain things within him. He admired, I think, just his virility, his intelligence, if that's the right word, and some of his humor as well. He was a funny man. There's no doubt about that from all the accounts of people who knew him well. And so they had this slightly peculiar relationship. It's an intense relationship. And there's also a good chance that Maxwell Knight used William Joyce briefly during the 30s as an MI5 informant. And that, I think, again, just clouds Maxwell Knight's vision. It makes it harder for him to see William Joyce for what he was. But then comes this extraordinary moment. And when I found the evidence of this in the archives, I was just flabbergasted. There comes this moment just 4 days before the outbreak of the Second World War, where William Joyce gets a call in the middle of the night on the phone from somebody who says that he's due to be arrested. And as a result of that call, William Joyce then flees the country. He goes off to Germany. He becomes Lord Haw-Haw. He becomes the main Nazi propagandist broadcasting into Britain. And somebody who had a real impact, who had millions and millions of listeners, and who was seen as a serious threat. The person who gave that call to William Joyce, who made that call, rather, was, it turns out, Maxwell Knight. And I remember just being stunned by this. And I don't think he did it for political reasons. I think he did it purely out of loyalty and friendship, that he felt that he owed William Joyce just the knowledge that he was going to be arrested. I don't for a second believe that he wanted William Joyce to escape. But that was, without doubt, the biggest mistake of his career, of Maxwell Knight's career. And I suppose the climax of Agent M is basically Knight trying to atone for this mistake. It's him trying to see what he can do now that the war has begun to not so much kind of take revenge on British fascism, but to try and adjust his legacy and respond to British fascism in a way that would keep the country safe.
Well, clearly it's been decades and no one else has found this little piece of information until you did. How likely is it that M's contemporaries at MI5 would have known that he was the one that made that phone call?
It's very likely, and I've seen the evidence that there were certainly fellow officers in MI5 who knew about this. And it's funny, I mean, there's also evidence of Maxwell Knight initially denying it, and then later saying, yes, I did make the call, but I didn't say what you think I said to William Joyce. And I think just in the kind of the maelstrom of the opening few months of the Second World War, which is when this was found out, it just got forgotten. There were so many other things going on. This was not something that enough people could really focus on. So I think, I mean, the short answer is some people knew about it, but not everyone.
So it had to be pretty extraordinary in Britain during the war at this time, especially spy mania at this point, because it would be hard to think otherwise, with all the ease of the German victories throughout Europe, that there were spies throughout all these countries, that, you know, no one really understood the German war machine at that point. So the perception, I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, was that there was a fifth column in each of these countries helping to defeat the army. How much did that hysteria come into Britain? And, you know, I would imagine Knight would have been at the center of it.
Mm. It came in a lot. It was an established trope in the press, and it was an idea that caught on very easily. It's largely because it was so similar to an idea which caught on before the First World War, during the invasion scares and the invasion literature that followed. The idea that basically every German living within Britain, or any Englishman or Englishwoman who had German heritage, was potentially a spy. That idea was simple. It was insidious. It caught on easily, and so it was a big deal. And there were some smatterings of evidence to suggest that this could actually be real. And certainly for Max von Knight and those in MI5, it was absolutely real. And this is a curious thing to describe as a historian. Because in some ways you've got to describe what they were feeling at that time and the evidence that they had, but also you have to come down in a fairly judgmental fashion to work out if they were right to feel that. And of course, some of the judgments they made about the threats that Britain faced, given what they knew, they were absolutely fair. And the strange thing is, we also know now that there was no fifth column, absolutely none. There was no network of British people with German heritage, or indeed just Germans living in Britain, who had formed a coherent pro-Berlin network. And yet, that fear existed. And as we all know, just from the history of any country under invasion or under the threat of invasion, this same fear will rear its head again and again. So it's understandable where it came from. And in this case, it was not justified.
Not taking anything away from their fears, because I totally understand where they're coming from. I'm wondering, though, if the obsession with some kind of a fifth column or German spies meant they overlooked spies sitting right in front of them. And the reason I'm asking this is because a very famous spy worked for Knight, Anthony Blunt, who I guess you write in the book that M maybe suspected him of being a spy but had no evidence. How much did we kind of look the other way? I know, there have been recent movies that have focused on, like, Karen Cross and others that have said, you know what, the Soviets aren't the priority now, the Germans are the priority, so we'll kind of take this up later on. Was that the case with Blunt? I mean, it seems pretty clear that M knew that he was a Soviet spy. How much did that matter at the time?
It mattered a lot to M. It mattered a huge amount. And it's a fascinating question. I think the majority of people I know, the majority of officers in MI5, did not for a moment think that the Soviets could have possibly got any agents inside MI5. And certainly when Max von Knight had the suspicion of Blunt, which was during the Second World War, the idea was dismissed by a lot of people in MI5 as just absurd, as something that was like imagining that you've seen the Loch Ness Monster. It was... The thinking within MI5 and MI6 at that time was that Moscow simply did not have either the will to put agents inside British intelligence, let alone the capability. And this is an idea which was supported cleverly by the Soviet Union itself, this idea they were completely bankrupted and they were on their last legs and they couldn't possibly mount an operation like that. Max von Knight was largely on his own. And as you said, the problem was he didn't have evidence. There was a moment when Anthony Blunt tried to move into Max von Knight's section, but Max von Knight refused. He said he didn't want that man working under him. And I've spoken to Knight's nephew about this, and apparently he described his uncle talking frequently about how he suspected Blunt was hiding something more than his sexuality. And it was, it really came down to just an instinctive feeling about this person. He, as I say, did not have the evidence, but he knew there was something not quite right about him. And I think that maybe that again goes back to him as a boy learning to read all these different animals and becoming later on in life an incredibly acute judge of character. And this is something that other people who got to know him or who worked for him would describe. How he had this ability to get to the nub of someone's personality in a very short space of time. And I think that is what happened here. And at the same time, there was not enough appetite within MI5 for the idea of there being a Soviet agent in their midst. It was just an outlandish idea at that time. And of course, what gave Maxwell Knight a second wind in his career was when it turned out that he had been right. And so in the 50s, when the extent of Soviet penetration of British intelligence and just British society became known, Maxwell Knight had his moment, because he was the person who had predicted it all along. He was seen as a Cassandra figure. And I think that extended his career within MI5 for possibly 5, almost 10 years, just the fact that he was right about Soviet penetration.
Well, a lot of hindsight historians like to look at, you know, the minute VE Day happened, the Cold War began, and all of a sudden everybody switched automatically from the Germans to the Soviets. How long did it take MI5, once the Second World War ended, to shift their focus back to the Soviet threat? Was it right away, or did it take until, like, maybe, you know, when Burgess defected McLean?
Absolutely right. The latter. Mm-hmm. It was absolutely not right away. And initially, some of the greatest threats in terms of MI5's priorities were, in fact, Israeli terrorist groups like Ergun or the Stern Gang, which of course affected British colonial possessions at that time. And there's a danger, there's a fear that those groups would soon start targeting the British mainland. So that was seen as more of a threat. There was the Irish question, but there was also a fear that that Nazi Germany might somehow come back to life, or at least there would be that fascism was not entirely dead. So it basically took 5-6 years for the focus to fully turn to the threat posed by Moscow. And again, I mean, I think during the first couple of years that was justified based on the evidence that they had, but during the next few years, less so.
Well, a lot of times when we look at former directors of major agencies like this, they have a quiet retirement. They, you know, fade off into the sunset. They go fishing. I think to Jim Clapper, who's the former DNI, just finished his job, just dying to just disappear. And if people remember, if they watched some of the hearings from a couple of weeks ago, how annoyed he was to have to be back answering some of these questions. He just wants to go live the rest of his life in peace. Knight had a pretty significant second career after working in British intelligence.
Yeah, he did indeed. And the amazing thing is that actually it overlapped with his career in British intelligence. So during the 1950s, while he was still working at MI5, Maxwell Knight reinvents himself as a BBC natural history broadcaster. So he starts doing hundreds and hundreds of radio programs, TV programs, writing books, all about his animals, about different pets that he's had or unusual animals that he's read about and learned about. And he becomes this David Attenborough figure, someone who is incredibly popular. He's much loved. He comes across as very avuncular and sort of friendly and familiar and stable. And he especially broadcasts to children. So there's a whole generation of people in Britain who grew up knowing his voice, but having no idea whatsoever that he was this top MI5 officer and, as I would argue, the greatest agent runner in MI5's history. But he managed to combine the two. And of course, this is one of the threads of the book, that actually these two parts of his life very much informed each other and complemented each other. The two parts being, on the one hand, his espionage, on the other hand, his naturalism. And there's a fascinating interplay between these.
Let me ask you this final question, because people have heard the term M. You know, anyone who's watched a Bond movie is familiar with this term. Did Fleming and Maxwell Knight know each other? Fleming, of course, was in British Naval Intelligence. Was there overlap? Why was it just random? Or is there a story behind this?
I think there are two things to say. First of all, in terms of Fleming and Maxwell Knight, I just don't know if they actually met. But what I can be sure of is that Fleming would have heard of Maxwell Knight and have known that he was calling himself M. And the kind of main thrust of my argument here is that within British intelligence, during the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, if you'd asked anyone working for MI5, MI6, Naval Intelligence, you name it, if you'd asked them about M, chances are they would have thought you were referring to Maxwell Knight. He was known as M throughout his career. He insisted from day one that this is what he was referred to as. He had a section called M Section, as you pointed out earlier. His agents were called M1, M2, or MA, MB. And he was someone who liaised throughout the intelligence world. So it wasn't just MI5 that he operated within. And for that reason, I think he has the strongest claim to be the M of British intelligence. There's a perfectly good chance that Fleming may have actually met Maxwell Knight. But if he did, I don't know about it. As in, I don't have the actual evidence.
Well, and he would have been dramatically lower in rank at that point. I mean, Maxwell Knight was far, far ahead of Fleming in the Second World War as far as their responsibilities are concerned.
Yeah. I mean, they had, absolutely. But I suppose beyond that, just socially, they certainly had some friends in common. And I think, you know, in answer to your question, I don't think it would have been a professional meeting. I think they might have met socially. Certainly Maxwell Knight knew the head of MI6 and some of his friends. And this guy was also friendly with Fleming at that time. So there's a perfectly good chance he would have been staying in the same house for a weekend during the war. That's not inconceivable. But I think, I mean, the main inspiration for the character M in Fleming's James Bond books was John Godfrey, his boss [S2] Right. [S1] In Naval Intelligence. But I think the kind of the secondary inspiration, i.e. why he chose the letter M of all the letters, I think that can be traced back to Maxwell Knight.
We would like to thank M8Z Choice and Scotty Vest for their support of SpyCast. Remember, you can try M8Z Choice free for 30 days. And after that, you will save 50% on your first month by visiting mhzchoice.com/spycast and use a code SPYCAST at checkout. And go to scottyvest.com/spycast. That's Scott, the letter E, vest.com. And for a limited time, you can enter the promo code SPY to get an extra 20% off.
Well, the book is Agent M, The Lives and Spies at MI5's Maxwell Knight. I recommend this on several levels. One, it's a fantastic spy story from a period in history that is particularly the pre-World War II stuff that we don't necessarily pay enough attention to. But for any budding historians out there or anyone interested in how this work gets done, this is truly a kind of detective mystery of putting together the pieces to try to discover the real identities of these particular agents. And that to me was the most fascinating. So Henry, thank you for taking the time to talk to us here on SpyCast. We look forward to having you back with your next book that comes out.
It's a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on SpyCast. Every Tuesday, we'll give you the most interesting conversations with some of the most intriguing people in the world of intelligence. If you'd like to send us a comment or suggestion, you can email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Or tweet us at @intlspycast. That's intlspycast. The International Spy Museum is a full 501c3 nonprofit institution. To help support future educational programming, please visit spymuseum.org and click on our Donate Now link at the top of the page. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.